This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Paul Grabowski, welcome to Joy.
David, a pleasure to be here.
Now, you are embarking on your final Adelaide Festival as artistic director.
Sadly, yes.
But leading up to it, you have had, like, just starting, you're from New Guinea.
I am from New Guinea.
How bizarre. I would have never guessed in a million years of all places that you would have been born.
Well, we're all born somewhere.
Somewhere, I know.
Yes, my father spent many years in New Guinea. He was there from 1930 until 39, and he went back in 56, and I was born in 58.
Right. Mm. And then the family moved here?
Yes, when I was very, very small. My mother, had me unexpectedly. She was getting on. She was 42 when she got pregnant, and she already had a child with my father who was 16 years older than I was. So clearly, I don't think it was on the agenda, particularly not up there in New Guinea. So having given birth, I think she gave my father quite serious instructions that they were to return to Australia, where it would probably be slightly less difficult for her to raise me. So that's what happened.
Right, okay. Mm. How old were you again when you came here?
Oh, just like less than 1 year
old. Oh, right, okay. So you've no memories.
Nothing at all.
And have you been back?
I haven't.
Right. Do you feel sad that you haven't taken that trip out?
It's sort of unfinished business for me. And whenever news comes up about New Guinea, as it has in the last, for example, as we talk now, there's just been a very strange, business going on with the Supreme Court in New Guinea to do with changes of government. I do find myself, very interested in what's going on up there. And, I have quite a few friends who either grew up in New Guinea or certainly have some kind of deeper connection to the place.
Right. Music, obviously a huge part of your life. When did you get involved with it?
Well, I can't remember a time where I wasn't involved with it. I have been really involved with music since infancy. And I kind of can say that with some kind of conviction because my mother used to tell me that I never really spoke much, or if at all, actually, until I was nearly two, and which actually gave her great cause for concern because she thought that possibly there was an issue of some kind. Mm. And then when I started speaking like in complete sentences. So really I'd been sitting around, it seems, listening a lot. And music was one of the things which I was immediately drawn to. I guess if a baby listens, then, that world of sound becomes something which is all-consuming.
Mm.
And whether it's people talking or, if you're making sense of the world through listening to it, then, of course, music becomes another language. People may be talking to you, but when you hear music, that's another kind of language. You understand it as having some kind of narrative content. So I can say with, I think, a fair degree of truth that music was possibly my first language. And I started to identify songs on the radio, tell my parents what they were called. Like they took me to Point Leo when I was, just short of two. And Take Five was playing over the loudspeakers, at the Life Saving Club, which was a hit in 1960.
Mm.
And I said, oh, that's Take Five, that.
At two?
Yeah, and they're going, okay.
Wow.
All right, that's pretty weird. So, my brother was a musician. He used to bring me records to listen to. Another cute thing was that, I treated records as very special things, and I used to try and wash the scratches off them in the hand basin at home. And I grew up in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne in Glen Waverley when it was an outer suburb, and really it was surrounded by orchards, and it was almost like living in the country.
Mm.
So, going to the city was a huge kind of excursion in those days. And my listening world really did consist of the radio and records until my parents bought me a piano when I was four, and I started lessons when I was five.
You didn't. You weren't one of those kids in the your teens that hated the piano lessons. No, you'd really enjoyed it.
No, in fact, I got more and more into it as I was a teenager. I realised that, you know, music was the thing that was my secret weapon.
Yeah.
I went to an all-boys school. I went to Wesley College in Melbourne, which was in those days incredibly all about sport, and I wasn't a sporty kid, and it was some consolation to know that, you know, playing music gave me some kind of interest factor that some of the more sort of sport hero type boys might have had. It was the ability to be able to do something quite well, which was of interest, because I learned to play, you know, Beatles songs or Joe Cocker or whatever was going on in 1971, 72. And also my ears were starting to kind of tune into other things as well. I was developing a kind of a listening life, which was an independent organism, getting away from what my piano teacher, who had a very Catholic kind of listening experience. I mean, he was kind of into all kinds of stuff. So he was not restrictive at all. But I was progressing way beyond even what he was telling me to concentrate on. And that was, you know, I discovered jazz when I was 15 and, you know, listened to the radio every night on the ABC. Monday to Friday, there was a show called Music to Midnight. And I was a great, you know, avid listener of that show. So the whole world of mainstream jazz, you know, artists like Oscar Peterson, Errol Garner, you know, the modern jazz quartet, Dave Brubeck, all that kind of more middle of the road, we would say now, although I now realise a lot of that music is incredible music. But it was not exactly, you know, Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, which was what I discovered when I was 18. And then I figured out, oh, right, I get it now. Jazz is Miles Davis and John Coltrane and Ornette Coleman. And once I sort of hit the kind of high art part of jazz, I was home then. I really felt like that was everything I loved about music kind of came together in one very distilled mass in the way that those guys went about the business of playing music. That was applied musical science, you know, expressed in the moment with incredible emotion. And I just thought, well, as an art form, it's got it all.
Did you find that you were a little bit of the odd one out with your peers? You know, because jazz, it's a particular sort of person that's into it, and especially that plays it as well.
Oh, look, in those days, particularly, because in the 70s in Melbourne, you know, jazz just wasn't on the radar. There was jazz. I mean, there were people playing it and there were people interested in it, but the scene was, you know, very, very small. There were really no venues and, you know, to be able to develop as a jazz musician was very, very difficult because you had very few people to bounce off. However, having said that, there was a small group of people, almost like a kind of a club, who had studied or had a relationship to a very important teacher in New York called Lenny Tristano, who jazz people will know or historians of the music would refer to as one of the high priests of what is known as cool jazz, a very cerebral intellectual approach and almost cultish in its definitions of, you know, what jazz is and more particularly what it isn't. So that, you know, I was very impressionable and that really did steer me towards the bebop tradition. So I started to listen a lot to people like Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, Lenny himself, Lenny Tristano, you know, that whole kind of group that really reformed and restoked the music's energy in the 1944 to 1954, say. But being somebody who's really not that interested in towing a particular ideological line, I soon sort of understood that jazz is something which never stands still. There isn't a thing called jazz. For me, jazz is a process. And so for me, it's been about applying the lessons of jazz, the lessons of improvisation, the lessons of You know, being able to apply all of the very sophisticated knowledge which it requires to be a good jazz musician to all kinds of different situations, be it film composing or, you know, festival directing or whatever it is that one finds oneself doing. There is something about having been a jazz musician which informs the way I go about those things.
Mm. What was your first big break?
Well, I've had a lot of breaks. Strangely, I guess one of my first big breaks, certainly in terms of, you know, having a challenge to stick my teeth into, I got a phone call one day. I can't remember who it was on the phone, but they said, we've got a situation. There's a singer called Robin Archer who's about to open a show at the Universal Workshop, which was a theatre in Fitzroy. And her musical director has taken ill and, you know, will be out of action for several weeks. This was 2 weeks out of the show opening. And we'd like you to step in. Now, I was 19, maybe 20. And the show, it turns out, was a show called A Star Is Torn.
Yep, know it well.
Right. Well, this was its premiere season. And then you will know that the band for A Star Is Torn was two pianists.
Mm.
Myself and a fella called Peter Head, who's still very much alive and well and working in Sydney. And the musical director was Robert Gavin. And Robert had taken ill. And so... okay, I turned up and it was a very challenging gig because, you know, as you know, the show consisted of Robin basically personifying or impersonating an incredible number of singers, cabaret singers and jazz singers, starting with Sophie Tucker or even earlier, I think, and ending up with Janis Joplin. You know, she did this whole virtuosic kind of thing. And so it involved having to play in a great variety of styles. And so that was my introduction to Robin's world, and that was a bit of an eye-opener for a kid from Glen Waverley in the 70s. You know, she was she lived life, you know, on the edge.
Yep.
And she had nothing to hide at all, and I learned a lot about the world. And of course, Robin's such an incredible intellectual, and I've got a brain like a steel trap. And remains one of my dearest friends, you know, to this day.
Does she go to Adelaide for your festivals?
If she can, she does, yeah.
Because she's been artistic director there, hasn't she?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
She did 1998 and 2000.
And one of them had that famous, the Virgin Mary with the accordion, which was banned.
Yeah, she hit a bit of a reef with that one, yeah. Yeah, so that was a break in the sense that it really threw me into a kind of truly high-pressure show business type situation in which you had to learn a lot of stuff very, very quickly and take control of it. I really enjoyed that. And then there's been, you know, a number of other things. I guess, you know, the next big break in a sense would have been my first film score. And that was done in 1986 when I got a call from my very dear friend Red Simons, who was working on a film for producer-director Bob Weiss, a film called Wills and Burke, which was a sort of comedy version of Burke and Wills. It didn't have a very long life, I'd have to say, this film.
I did see it.
Did you see it?
It was terrible.
Good Lord, you must have been the only other person. It was a shocker. So, look, but it was my break into writing film music because I came in as the kind of assistant on it. But off the back of it, Bob asked me to do his next project, which was a TV miniseries based on the Petrov Affair, which was a terrific thing for the ABC, I think. Well, no, actually, no, it was Channel 7. But that was a proper, really, really nice piece of work. And, you know, I got to write everything and every note of the music. And I got a real kind of sense of, you know, what it could be like to be a film composer. So, you know, these are the things which open doors. You know, you start somewhere which seems awful, but it leads to something else. So that was important for me. Mm. And then I guess doing Fast Forward with Steve, you know, which he produced, Faza, that is, was another big break because that led to Tonight Live. So I look at big breaks as being things that in themselves are not significant but lead to.
Yeah, because that was a five-night-a-week TV show.
Yeah.
That ran for quite a few years too, didn't
four
it?
Four,
4 years.
Yeah.
And so you became quite well known because of that, didn't you? You know, as a TV personality.
Yeah, I did. It was very strange. You know, one minute I was obscure, you know, basically known in the jazz world, but no one would have known me from a bar of soap outside of that. And the next minute, you know, I was being kind of yelled at by truck drivers, you know, nicely, and, you know, recognised all over the place. I mean, that can have its good and bad sides. Mm. And I would say that, in the celebrity firmament, I was a very, very minor star indeed. And it makes me wonder how people who are truly in the public eye can stand it. I mean, it must be really difficult to be, you know, to feel... Well, when you're of such kind of celebrity that people feel that they've got a piece of you, and I think that that's what the nature of celebrity is.
Mm.
People think they know you. Well, they actually don't, of course.
Mm.
And so people feel absolutely no compunction in coming up and, you know.
Because you're in their lounge room, so they, of course they think.
You're part of the family.
Yeah, you're part of the family.
Yeah.
And 5 nights a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very interesting sort of time, I should imagine.
It was a fascinating time. It was a whirlwind. That show was an unprecedented success in the sense that at that time slot, nothing had rated that high. Of course, we'd had a history of variety shows and those kinds of things which had been very popular, like Graham Kennedy and Don Lane and people like that. But the kind of numbers we were getting with Tonight Live were kind of prime time.
Mm.
We were rating in the 20s, you know. Mm. After 10:30 at night.
And you had some of the biggest international acts coming through too, didn't you?
Well, anybody who was, you know, in Australia would come on that show. I mean, the difficult thing about maintaining a show like that in Australia is the fact that, you know, Australia is a small market. Now, you know, with Letterman, you turn on the show any night and there's going to be some household name on the show.
Mm.
You can't really keep that up. Night after night after night, year in, year out in Australia. It's very, very hard.
Mm.
But, you know, look, we made a good fist of it. And I think, you know, Steve was a brilliant host. He's got that kind of combination of skills which makes it all work. And, you know, we remain very good friends to this day. And I ask him on the odd occasion if he's ever considering going back to TV. And who knows? I mean, he's the sort of guy you never know. One day he might do it.
And with cable, there are so many opportunities
these days,
aren't there? And that's the lovely thing about TV now. It's not just the four channels. It's open up to so many. And you can get very interesting shows nowadays, which is fantastic.
Well, there's such choice now, David.
Mm. Now, you know, like, there are so many things you have done. Vince Jones, I'd love to talk to you about Vince Jones.
Yep.
Do you want to have a quick word about him?
Well, yeah, sure. Vince was a guy who I think is one of the unsung heroes of jazz because, you know, if it wasn't for Vince and the work that he did during the early 80s, I don't think jazz would have kind of come back into the public imagination in quite the same way as it did.
And he made it so cool too, didn't he? You know, like the whole look that he had, and the crowds that went to see him. I can remember over in Fitzroy, there was the pub, I can't remember the name of it now, on the corner there. And yet there would be queues out the front every Friday night when he'd be playing there.
Yes, the Tank of Alarms.
The Tank of Alarms, that's it.
Absolutely. And, you know, Vince is a great singer.
Mm.
He deserves, you know, recognition as a truly great jazz singer. And, you know, musicians are all of the opinion that he's an extraordinary musical figure. So, yes, he really was responsible for quite a few young musicians getting their first taste of being able to make a career.
Yep.
I came into his orbit in 87 when I was asked to produce one of his albums, which is called It All Ends Up in Tears.
Oh, yep, yep.
And then I joined the band actually as sort of quasi-musical director, I guess, in late 88 and stayed through until the end of 89.
Okay. I've got so much respect for that man. Mm. Australian Arts Orchestra. Tell us a little bit about that.
The Art Orchestra was founded in 1994. Originally, it came about because the late Richard Werrett asked me, well, I asked him actually. I went to him with a proposal for the Melbourne Festival in 1993, which was some music that I had arranged based on European popular songs of the 1930s and 40s. Arranged for a contemporary jazz ensemble, which I had done for a group in Germany. And he was very taken with it. And he gave us three nights at the Malthouse. So this is a piece called Ringing the Bell Backwards. And so that happened, and we all had a great time. It got amazing reviews. And I thought, well, look, here's an opportunity. The musicians were chosen from all around the country. And I thought, here's a chance to create a kind of a peak ensemble playing music which is not classical music. It's not exactly jazz either. It's somewhere in the middle. It's contemporary music. And we could explore lots of different, you know, musical projects if we're able to, you know, get the right sort of circumstances to do that. So a group of people helped me to set up the kind of legal structure for such an organisation to exist. And now, 17 years later, the Australian Art Orchestra is, you know, travelling internationally, doing projects with, you know, Paul Kelly and Indigenous musicians from Arnhem Land and musicians from India and Korea. And it's an extraordinary organisation doing really amazing things.
You must be very proud of that.
I am proud of it, David. I think, you know, of everything that I've done, it's probably the achievement that, you know, I feel, well, that was really worth hanging in there for. Mm. Mm. And, you know, you and I have a mutual friend, Philip Mortlock, who, you know, was very instrumental in its early days because he actually financed our very first recording.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
The Hush series.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that.
Chapter 7, the Hush series. Well, the Hush series is the creation of a doctor, a haematologist, actually, at the Royal Children's Hospital called Dr. Catherine Croc. She's an amazing woman, unstoppable energy. She does a billion things, all very well. And she's a person who believes in the concept of patient-centered care, which is that... whilst, of course, it takes medical professionals to come up with the various ways of healing people using medicine, that maybe there's another way of tilting the whole experience whereby the families and the people who are central to the patient have far more of a role to play. And as an adjunct to that, she also thinks about the environment in which people are attempting to get well, and of course the hospital is the first place. And she, being a haematologist, is a person, for example, who conducts procedures like lumbar punctures on children who may, you know, have blood illnesses. So she's used to having patients and their carers or their parents in rooms in which something is going to happen which may seem like it's going to be quite traumatic, although she never makes it traumatic. She always, you know, uses anesthetics or something which is going to prevent the patient from having any pain at all. But she also wants the place itself to feel like a benign place, a good place to be. And so she uses music to do that. And you know, I had a child who was in hospital for quite a long time receiving treatment, so I had plenty of chance to sit around experiencing these environments. And they can be pretty awful because, you know, all you ever hear is children's television or, you know, you get the feeling of tension and stress wherever you go. And when she asked me if I'd like to do something for her Hush project, I thought, yeah, I'd love to. So, and I said, you know, jazz would be pretty good because jazz can be a music of great lightness and buoyancy and air. So I did this album for her called Love's Calendar, which is 12 pieces, each based on a month of the year. And for the Hush Project, and every CD in the Hush Project which is sold raises money for the Hush Foundation, and the Hush Foundation spends that money on projects designed to alleviate pain in children's hospitals. So anything which, you know, is working towards pain relief, we fund. And we've raised around $1 million.
Excellent.
In that area through this series. And now it's all about, you know, creating new music, music by great people for a great cause.
Name some of the people.
Well, the most recent one is Joe Kendamo, wonderful jazz pianist and composer-arranger who's done an album of sort of jazz treatments of Mozart, which he's done with his partner Zoe Black. It's really a fantastic project. Oh, she's a violinist who works with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. Before that, well, this is not in any particular order, but the Gregorian Brothers did a magnificent CD. Andrea Keller's done one. Tony Gould's done one. I've done a couple. You know, the next one will be Mark Isaacs. We're doing one with the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra. There's a whole heap.
How can you get your hands on those?
Well, they're available at Dimmocks, for example, and, you know, good retail outlets, ABC mm-hmm. stores sell them.
Yep. Just and through the hospital?
Of course, the hospital, yes, as well.
Yep. And it's not just the Children's Hospital here in Melbourne now, it's hospitals around Australia.
That's right.
Isn't
wherever
it?
Wherever the CDs are sold, the money goes to some project in that state.
Mm. Which is good that it's actually expanded out through the whole of Australia.
It's funny where you see them. For example, Her Majesty the Queen, when she was recently here in Australia, was given a Hush CD.
Oh, excellent.
And there's a photograph on the Hush website, I think, of the Queen holding her Hush CD as she's inaugurating the new children's hospital.
Wonderful.
So they might be listening to it in the palace.
Breakdancing to it in the palace. Now, next year, your final Adelaide Festival.
Yes.
How are you feeling about it?
Very excited is the, you know, the simple answer. It's a great program.
Because it takes a long time, doesn't it, to actually pull this off? You know, like many years. How many years in the making for next year's festival?
Well, look, I started working in Adelaide 4 years ago, and I think, you know, seeds were sown 4 years ago, which have finally matured in this festival. So, yeah, you can easily work for years until you finally land some of the acts that you really want to get.
Yeah, and that is the hard thing, isn't it? Because you're not the only festival in the world, even though the Adelaide Arts Festival is one of the premium arts festivals. But these people are busy, you know, like they've got busy schedules around the world and trying to lock
they
them
are busy
in.
People.
Yeah, you yes. know, like for that couple of weeks of the year.
And Adelaide's a long way to come.
It is, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, like the opening weekend, we've got Ennio Morricone coming. Mm. Your listeners will undoubtedly know that Ennio Morricone, the composer of, you know, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, or The Mission, or Cinema Paradiso, is a busy man.
And I'm a busy man.
He's a busier man. And but, you know, we've managed to get him for our opening weekend. He's conducting an outdoor event with the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra, a 100-voice choir and a group of soloists in Elder Park, which is beautiful parkland next to the Adelaide Festival Theatre.
And that's right on the edge of the river
on
that
the
runs through. Yeah. Which is a beautiful setting, isn't it?
It's a beautiful setting.
And the weather, it's generally pretty good at that time of the year in Adelaide, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You know, it's generally warm and, you know, long summer nights.
And people love that opening weekend, don't they?
They do. It's a big opening weekend. There's always a big party. And we're building an amazing thing up on the area between the rear wall of Parliament House and the festival centre. Is something called the Hayek Plaza, which is this kind of...
The club? Is it
We're building something called the Barrio, which will be the festival club.
Right.
Which is based on the idea of a shanty town.
Ah, excellent.
So it's going to be this sort of maze of extraordinary things, 8 bars, you know, amazing music program up there.
And so what happens there that every night, all the performers, not all of them, but a lot of them that have been performing through the festival come and play 2 or 3 songs. Is that right?
Well, that could happen. We've got a bespoke program of bands that are playing there as well. Both early and late at night. All sorts of strange events are going to happen in the Barrio. You know, you will be accosted by various performers in various disguises. You'll be asked to leave an offering at the altar, which is the way that you'll get into it.
Right.
Strange markets will be held there, dealing in strange things. It's going to be a kind of a, you know, a theatre of dreams, if you like. And a place to expect the unexpected.
Excellent. Sounds fantastic. Mm. And that's open every night.
Every night.
During the festival.
Yeah.
What else? What else is exciting you?
Well, we've got the Théâtre de l'Odéon from Paris, you know, one of the world's oldest theatre companies, are coming with a production of Streetcar named Desire, but it's called Une Tramway, starring the great Isabelle Huppert. And directed by Christoph Walakowski, who is one of the kind of most controversial and in-demand directors in Europe now. We've got a production of The Caretaker by Harold Pinter, starring Jonathan Pryce. We have the wonderful Cloud Gate Dance Theatre from Taiwan. We have the incredible Ballet Serre de la Baie with Gardenia, which is a show based around the closing of a drag club in Belgium. And this is an amazing show, actually, where Alain Platel, who's one of the great, you know, choreographers of our time, has worked with a group of people who've been real drag performers in their lives, in the sort of demi-monde of the drag world in Belgium, and has turned them into the most extraordinary performers that you will ever see. I mean, this is the ultimate drag show. it's got everything. It's poignant, it's sad, it's hilarious. It's essentially about the beauty within.
Yep.
You know, it's about drag as the extraction of the beauty within oneself. And I think that they've really nailed it. It's been getting incredible reviews all over the world, the show. So we're very happy to have that as well. There's a very challenging show from Hungary called Hard to Be God, which deals with human trafficking and the sex trade.
Oh.
In a very uncompromising way, very brave theatre. We've got the Bernstein Mass with the wonderful Jubilant Sykes performing as the celebrant. And conducted by Christian Järvi. That's selling very, very quickly too. That's a wonderful piece, which is, you know, something that Bernstein composed for the inauguration of the Kennedy Center in New York. It was commissioned by Jackie Kennedy and composed in 1970. Fantastic work. Ah, gosh, David, there's so much stuff. Then there's the whole visual arts program, of course, and there's Writers' Week.
Which I always love Writers' Week. It's one of my favorite, you know, like being an Adelaide boy was the highlight of the festival for me. Was and it's so big now, isn't it?
Well, you know, we've got Alan Hollinghurst, the book-winning, you know, writer from the UK. We've got one of the greatest writers in the Spanish language. His name is Javier Cercas, and another one, Gabriel Garcia Vazquez from Colombia. We've got writers of children's fiction, some very important writers of non-fiction, screenwriters. It's a very broad kind of Writers' Week now. It's been curated by Laura Croach, who's totally got her finger on the pulse. So, you know, whereas it used to be more focused on, you know, I would say English-speaking fiction and appealing, well, I think it's safe to say largely to an older demographic. We're now spreading the net much wider.
Mm. What I also love about Adelaide during its festival is the city comes alive, doesn't it? You know, like you really sense that there is a festival on when you're walking around the streets.
You do. Well, I mean, there's so much happening. You know, there's the festival, there's the Fringe, there's WOMAD. You know, it's all happening at the same time.
Mm. Now, WOMAD, of course, is actually run by the festival centre, isn't it?
No, it's actually run by APA, the Australian Performing Associate. Well, who are they? It's Ian Scobie's right. company okay. runs it.
Right.
And
it's Peter Gabriel who sort of had the concept.
He founded it. Yep. It was his idea in the first instance.
And it's in the most beautiful park at the back of the Botanical Gardens.
It's in the most beautiful setting. It's probably the best setting for that event in the world, actually. I think that's generally acknowledged. And it draws its own audience of tens of thousands of people. And that's in the middle weekend of the Adelaide Festival. So you can imagine, the place is just pumping. You know, it's really hard to get a hotel room even now in Adelaide. So if anyone out there is listening to this and they think, gosh, I'd better get down there, don't hesitate.
Yeah, or ring those friends or relatives that you've got there and say, hey, remember me?
Absolutely. We're even starting a billeting program, actually, because, you know, we're reaching the point of critical mass.
Yeah. It's important for Adelaide, isn't it? Because often a forgotten city of Australia, but this arts festival brings people from all over the world and interstate. So, and it's been around for such a long time, hasn't it?
It has. It's been around since 1960. It's not the oldest arts festival. Actually, Perth has that honour. But it is the one which very quickly assumed the crown as the main event in that regard for many, many years. Now, of course, it has rivals in all of the major cities in Australia. But there's not going to be a festival this season like the Adelaide Festival next year. It has got wow factor.
And on purpose, have you done the wow factor?
Absolutely.
As a farewell?
You're damn right I have.
You want to be remembered, don't you?
I do. Well, I'm not leaving quietly, David.
What's the one thing that you want to be remembered for your Adelaide Festival?
Well, you know, we've done a couple of pretty wonderful things that I'm very proud of. I think, you know, in the last festival we had Le Grand Macabre, which was an amazing operatic production of a work which we're never going to otherwise see here, done by, you know, the best possible people. And that was great. You know, it was fantastic to have that. We also had a great concentration on contemporary Indigenous work in the last festival, which, you know, there was a piece that called Wrong Skin that I commissioned, which I'm really proud of. This festival, well, I think, you know, our new look Writers Week is something to be very proud of. Also, the very coherent visual arts program that Victoria Lynn has constructed for both festivals is something which I think has put the visual arts back on the agenda within the Adelaide Festival as, you know, something to be taken very seriously. Mm. So that's very important to me as well. So, look, you know, I think I've achieved quite a lot.
Good. So you'll have a lie down after this and think, thank God that's over.
I doubt it. I'm not the lying down type.
So what's next? What's your first project after the festival finishes?
Well, you know, the Art Orchestra's got quite a busy year next year. We're touring in Europe towards the end of the year, and there's a number of other projects leading up to that. I believe Fred Skepsy's got another movie in the works. I just scored his last one, which was called The Eye of the Storm. So we have an ongoing relationship and possible projects also with Paul Cox and a couple of other filmmakers. So there's that. And I'm very excited about I have a sextet, which is my current jazz unit. I wrote a whole new suite of works for that group last Christmas, and we've been performing it during the year at various places, and I'm hoping to record it next year. But I think that's some of my strongest work in jazz, actually, so I'm looking forward to getting that out to the world as well.
Paul Grabowski, you've got to come back real soon. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, David.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.